Welcome to Food for Thought podcast. Today's episode is Pig Laws and Black Codes, Why Voting Matters. Hi everyone, Colleen Patrick-Gaudreau here. You can find me at joyfulvegan.com and on social media. Thank you so much for subscribing to Food for Thought and thank you for supporting it. It's a 100% listener-supported podcast, so you can join other listeners in supporting Food for Thought and receiving podcast transcripts as well as other bonuses and perks by going to patreon.com/ColleenPatrickGaudreau. It's been wonderful to connect with so many of you in my online cooking classes I've been teaching every week. The classes are so much fun. They're interactive, they're real time, and they're fancy schmancy. I've got a multi-camera set up. You can see me talking and me preparing the food. You can see the counter and you can see me at the same time. If you don't want to see me, that's also an option. You can just look at the food. You get recipes in advance, so you can cook along with me if you like, and you get a recording of our class at the end. I pick a different theme every week, and we've got some really fun ones coming up, including air fryer, Italian cuisine from Tuscany in particular, Middle Eastern cuisine, lots of outdoor, wonderful, delicious, plant-forward food, vegan, delicious, plant-based, whatever you want to call it. So go to joyfulvegan.com/classes to register. And of course, if you are a Patreon supporter, you receive 10% off of each class. So make sure you check your account for the discount code. Hello, everyone. I hope you are all doing fabulously well. In the last episode, I shared my perspective about why and how we can and should all be involved politically on either the federal, state, or local level as a means for initiating change in the issues we care about, whether we're focused on human rights or civil rights or animal protection or environmental protection or any and all of the above and beyond. Today, I want to offer some food for thought about a vital aspect of political engagement that has been hard won for most segments of the population, and that's voting. And we're going to talk about how hard won these rights have been. If you've ever doubted the power of voting, all you need to do is take a look at the history of and the struggle for suffrage, for the right to vote in this country, because the power of voting can be measured by the efforts to forbid, suppress, limit, and restrict it. And that's what we're going to talk about today. A little history, couple animologies, animal-related words and expressions, and lots of resources if you want to get involved in exercising this most basic, most powerful right, and in making sure others can as well. If you care about animal protection, then you will want to exercise your power and privilege in voting for the people and policies that will protect animals and their lives and their habitats. If you care about human rights, then you will want to exercise your power and privilege in voting for the people and policies that will protect those rights. If you care about protecting our oceans and forests and air and earth from poison and demise, then you will want to exercise your power and privilege in voting for the people and policies that will protect them. If you care about unfair laws and smarmy tactics, and we're going to talk about those as well, that keep people, especially those who are already disenfranchised, from voting, then you will want to exercise your power and privilege to ensure other people can gain and exercise their own. If you're apathetic about voting, I just hope you'll keep listening. Now, a little history going back a couple hundred years, talking about the founders of this country. They believed in the virtues of democracy. They were influenced, obviously, by classic Greek and Roman lawmakers. And they, despite that, accepted and endorsed severe limits on voting and granted the right to vote to a small subset of society, as you know, white male property owners. Now, over the centuries, since the founding of this country, voting rights became a bipartisan priority, and you will see that as people worked at all levels to enact constitutional amendments and laws, making sure no one is denied the right to vote based on race and ethnicity, gender, disability, age, or other factors. Yes, these rights have been hard won, but they've been won. Yes, some groups of people work to chip away at these rights, but that's because they're losing. Let me explain. As voting rights expanded to Black men, to women, to Native Americans, to young people, to the disabled, there's always been a contingency that has attacked those rights in order so that they may maintain their control. And they continue to do this today. And while it's shameful and quite pathetic, really, it's not a reason to despair. It's actually a reason to feel emboldened. Because remember this, if you remember nothing from this episode, and I hope you'll remember more than this, but please remember this, the harder opponents of free, fair, and easy voting fight, the more they show how weak they are. Their opposition to fair, free, easy voting reflects their awareness that their power is waning. Whoever attacks these rights, these most basic constitutional rights, the hardest, whoever uses underhanded, duplicitous, deceptive tactics to stop others from exercising their constitutional right to vote, it's because they're losing and they know it. Voter suppression is a pretty hollow strategy, born of moral and intellectual bankruptcy. It demonstrates a lack of ideas and a lack of vision. And that's the point. Enlightenment ideals of progress and science and reason and humanism and sympathy that informed the minds of the founders of this nation, that enhance human and non-human flourishing, those ideals have been winning. And while the gains certainly haven't been easy, they haven't been on a straight line, it's not been a linear process, and certainly not without suffering, there has been so much progress since this democratic experiment began almost 250 years ago. Progressive policies are winning. Progressive in the sense of progress, in the sense of forward-looking as opposed to backward-turning. Progressive policies are winning and regressive policies are losing. Progressive policies are shared and voted for by the majority of the population. That's why the entrenched powers that be are fighting so hard to make sure as few people vote as possible, because they know they would be extinct already if they didn't suppress the votes and voices of forward-thinking, future-looking, progressive-minded citizens. Progressive, literally in the sense of progress, of improving systems and structures so everyone benefits, not just the elite few. Progressive as the opposite of regressive. Regressives is what I call them. It's a good word for them. Regressives, they're not evil, but they are afraid. They're staring their extinction in the face and they're holding on with all their might, even if in their last gasp, they use deceitful, smarmy, undemocratic tactics to turn the clock back, just as the defeated Southern rebels did at the end of the Civil War. From the moment the American Civil War ended in 1865 and for the century that followed, scores of Black men, women, and children were intimidated, terrorized, lynched, brutally beaten, and viciously murdered to stop them from enjoying the same rights as their white erstwhile slaveholders. In the South, especially among those rebel losers who never let go of their white supremacist worldview, right, they convulsed at the idea that the Black population they once owned would have an equal voice and vote in what they deemed a whites-only political system. And so they did everything they could to make sure their white supremacy wasn't diminished by the call for equality and protection for all under the law, under the government of the people, by the people, and for the people. So as of 1847 or so, just a few years before Southern rebels took up arms against the United States government and launched the Civil War, a few states allowed Black men to vote: Massachusetts, Vermont, Maine, New Hampshire, and Rhode Island. A pretty small segment of the population outside of white men, right? White landowners, male landowners. And it would take a bloody war in which almost 700,000 people were killed to change that. In April 1865, as the Civil War drew to a close, Lincoln shocked many by proposing limited suffrage for African Americans in the South. He was assassinated days later, and his successor, Andrew Johnson, would be the one to preside over the beginning of Reconstruction. A virulent white supremacist, Johnson wanted quick restoration of the seceded states to the Union without protecting the former slaves. In fact, he denounced the extension of civil and political liberty to Black Americans. This led to conflict. He was a Democrat, Southern Democrat, and this led to conflict with the Republican-dominated Congress, a Republican pro-abolitionist dominated Congress. And it was only because of the dedication of this pro-abolitionist, pro-Reconstruction Republican Congress and then general and national superstar Ulysses S. Grant, who won this, you know, who basically brought victory to the Union, and he would become president after Johnson. I mean, it's only because of them that freed slaves were given any protections at all. Under Johnson's Reconstruction policies, nearly all the newly elected Southern state legislatures, largely dominated by former Confederate leaders, would enact their own, quote, Black Codes, they were called, in 1865 and 1866. Now, these codes granted a few certain freedoms to African Americans, but their primary purpose was to restrict them, restrict their labor, restrict their activity. For instance, they were denied the rights to testify against whites, to serve on juries, or in state militias. They were forbidden to vote, or to start a job without the approval of a previous employer. Another attempt to reclaim the familiar Southern order of subjugator and subjugated, several states enacted what were called pig laws. In Mississippi, Florida, Georgia, and Alabama, for instance. And these pig laws focused on increasing, enhancing penalties for what would have once been considered just a misdemeanor, but were now considered a felony. So for instance, in Mississippi, a new law lowered the dollar threshold for what constituted grand larceny. So at one time, that offense, which would be punishable for by up to 5 years in prison, that dollar was lowered from $25 to $10 to constitute grand larceny. $10. More drastic still, the law provided that stealing any, quote, hog, pig, cow, calf, yearling, steer, bull, sheep, lamb, goat, or kid of the value of $1 or more would be punished as grand larceny, again, punishable by a prison term of up to 5 years. Now, there's a whole other conversation about the value of animals. Of course, we're talking about, you know, a dollar. But you can see how this provision got, how the statute got its name, the pig law. It was blatantly racist because the whites owned most of the livestock, owned most of the, you know, cattle and quote unquote livestock. So the pig law stayed on the books for decades. And when the Jim Crow era began, it was expanded with even more discriminatory laws. Now, in the years following the Civil War, the end of the Civil War, there were a trio of amendments in addition to civil rights laws that were passed to expand citizenship and voting rights. So there's the 13th Amendment. Sure, you are all familiar with that. Ratified in 1865. Lincoln was still alive. He would die just a short time later. But the 13th Amendment abolished and prohibited slavery and established a degree of citizenship for former slaves. But there was so much more work to do. Now, the Civil Rights Act of 1866 came next, and that was the nation's first civil rights law. It declared all males born in the United States to be citizens without distinction of race or color or previous condition of slavery or involuntary servitude. Now, it didn't offer any protection for voting rights. Andrew Johnson, President of the United States, vetoed the bill. And though the Republican-led Congress successfully overrode his veto and made it into law in April of 1866, it was the first time in history that Congress overrode a presidential veto of a major bill. The 14th Amendment came next. This was ratified in 1868, and it granted citizenship to all persons born or naturalized in the United States, including former slaves, and guaranteed all citizens equal protection under the laws. Andrew Johnson openly opposed the 14th Amendment. Now, the 14th Amendment gave former slaves citizenship rights, But it did not address voting rights, and it also didn't apply to Native people. Native Americans were only able to win the right to vote by fighting for it state by state. So the 15th Amendment is next, and the 15th Amendment was ratified by Congress and now President Grant in 1870, and it prohibited voting rights discrimination on the basis of race. To enforce these amendments, however, Congress also passed a number of enforcement acts that criminalized the obstruction of voting rights and provided for federal supervision of the electoral process. You always know what's going wrong when you see what laws are passed, because the fact that the 15th Amendment wasn't enough to stop freed slaves, black men and women, from being massacred in the South, says a lot. They had to pass these enforcement acts. The third of these enforcement acts is also known as the Ku Klux Klan Act, and it targeted the Klan for acting violently and deliberately, horrifically, to prevent African Americans from exercising their rights as citizens, burning black schools, intimidating voters, attacking, whipping, killing African Americans. The Klan was hell-bent on dismantling the policies of Reconstruction. So Grant and his attorney general, Amos Ackerman, dealt them a fatal blow that by 1872, the Klan had been defeated. The weight of the federal government broke the back of this organization, and it reduced racial violence throughout the South. Frederick Douglass declared that without Grant's actions, black Americans likely would have been trapped in a condition similar to slavery. The violence, of course, did not end altogether, but the Klan was no longer the formidable player it was. But it would return 50 years later when it arose in the 1920s. Now, again, there was still violence in the South, don't get me wrong, and blacks were still being killed with no consequences at all to the perpetrators. But crushing the Klan, as was done, was essential to at least restore some semblance of order, and it did crush the power they had in the South. Now, during this period, this was a period that's considered the period of Reconstruction. It goes from 1867 to 1877. Blacks won election to Southern state governments and even to the U.S. Congress, and I don't think a lot of people know this. The first African-American to serve in the Senate, Hiram Rhodes Revels of Mississippi, was sworn in on February 23rd, 1870. Now, he was almost blocked by Democrats, then the party of white Southerners, who didn't want a black man serving in Congress. But over the next decade, but he prevailed and he remained, 15 more black men would take their seats in the House and Senate as Reconstruction allowed a very radical, though very brief, transformation of government. The final black congressman from the South is George White, who gives his farewell address in 1901, and there would be no more black members of Congress from the original 11 Confederate states until 1973, when Andrew Young Jr. of Georgia and Barbara Jordan of Texas took their seats. So in the 1870s, as I said, even though the Ku Klux Klan had been squashed, there were many other organizations kind of trying to take their place. Organizations like the White League and the Red Shirts, they were terrorizing and intimidating black men so they couldn't vote and participate in government. States, particularly those in the South, continued to suppress black voters' rights, not only by violence and murder, but also by legalizing disenfranchisement in the form of Jim Crow laws, which remained firmly in place for almost a century. And Jim Crow laws entrenched the institution of segregation and racial discrimination from the end of Reconstruction, really the failure of Reconstruction, the end of it in 1877 up until the mid-1960s. Now, some of you might be asking, where does the term Jim Crow come from to refer first to black men, then to these racist laws and customs? It's traced back to a song from the 1820s, which is so... Here's a snippet. Come listen, all you gals and boys, I'm gonna sing a little song. My name is Jim Crow. Wheel about and turn about and do just so. Every time I wheel about, I jump Jim Crow. I'm reading it exactly as the words are spelled on the sheet music from the song, and yes, it's horribly racist. The song Jim Crow was written by Thomas Dartmouth Daddy Rice. Rice, so the story goes, was a struggling actor at the Park Theater in New York, and he happened upon, so the story goes, a black person singing the above song. Now, some accounts say it was an old black slave who walked with difficulty. Others say it was a ragged black stable boy. But whether modeled on an old man or a young boy, we don't know. But what we do know is that in 1828, Rice appeared on stage as Jim Crow, as this character, this exaggerated, highly stereotypical black character, which unfortunately became very popular as he took the show on the road all the way from the East Coast of the United States to London and Dublin, Ireland, etc. By the 1830s, Jim Crow was a stock character in minstrel shows, along with counterparts you would have heard of Jim Dandy or Zip Coon. And Rice's subsequent blackface characters were Sambos, Coons, and Dandies. That's what they would have been called. White audiences were very receptive to the portrayals of these horribly racist characters as singing, dancing, grinning fools. Now, crow had been a derogatory term for a black man, presumably because the birds are black, even before Rice wrote his song. But by 1838, the term Jim Crow was being used as a collective racial epithet for blacks, not as offensive as some other epithets, but pretty offensive still. The popularity of minstrel shows clearly aided the spread of Jim Crow as a racial slur. Now, this use of the term lasted only a half a century. By the end of the 19th century, the words Jim Crow were less likely to be used to derisively describe blacks, but instead now it became the phrase being used to describe the laws and customs which oppressed blacks, and that's how it came to be. This seems like a good place to stop, take a breath, and to express some gratitude to you. So speaking of the democratic process of the people, for the people, and by the people, because of your support, I'm able to do this podcast, quite literally. That's how this works. And I want to give a quick shout out to all of you. Thank you so much for your support, especially Brooke Bussard, Michal Stone, David Cabrera, Alexander Gray. Thank you to all of the new supporters and everyone at every level. Remember, you get written transcripts at $10 a month and above. At $20 a month, you get an audio recording of a loving kindness meditation, etc. There's so many perks and they're being added all the time. But just knowing that this is possible because of you, hopefully that is something I think most of you do it for. But of course, I want to be able to just give back to you and thank you for your generosity and support. So visit patreon.com/ColleenPatrickGaudreau or just visit joyfulvegan.com and click on the donate button. So the Jim Crow laws were laws and customs meant to disenfranchise blacks by removing political and economic gains made by them during the Reconstruction period. Gains such as the right to vote, ratified in the 15th Amendment. Voting rights advocates, by the way, for women, suffragists as they would have been called, were disappointed to say the least that they weren't granted the right to vote when blacks were. Many women suffragists and black suffragists worked together on getting voting rights for both blacks and women. Frederick Douglass and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Susan B. Anthony, they worked together. Unfortunately, it would take many more years of organizing and activism until women nationwide won the right to vote with the ratification of the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution in 1920. For black men and women, however, the struggle for equal voting rights marched into the 1960s as many states, particularly in the South, dug in on policies such as literacy tests, poll taxes, property requirements, English language requirements, and more, all aimed at suppressing the vote among people of color, immigrants, and low-income populations. In March of 1965, a full 100 years later, activists such as Hosea Williams, John Lewis, Martin Luther King led organized protest marches such as the 54-mile march from Selma, Alabama to the state capital of Montgomery to spotlight the issue of black voting rights. The first march was brutally attacked by police and others on a day that came to be known as Bloody Sunday. After a second march was cut short, a throng of thousands finally made the journey, arriving in Montgomery on March 24th and drawing nationwide attention to this issue. Now, just a couple months before, in January 1965, the United States ratified the 24th Amendment to the Constitution, prohibiting any poll tax in elections for federal officials. Now, again, poll taxes were a particularly egregious form of voter suppression for the century between the end of the Civil War and the 1960s, forcing people to pay money in order to vote. The taxes were expressly designed to keep African Americans and low-income white people from voting. The 24th Amendment was approved by Congress in 1962 and was ratified by the states 2 years later. In a 1966 case, the Supreme Court ruled that poll taxes are unconstitutional in any U.S. election, not just federal elections. Now, in 1965, now a little later in 1965, inspired by the voting rights marches in Alabama, Congress passed the Voting Rights Act. The vote was decisive and bipartisan, 79-18 in the Senate and 328-74 in the House. President Lyndon Johnson signed the measure on August 6th with Dr. Martin Luther King, Rosa Parks, and other icons of the civil rights movement at his side. The Voting Rights Act of 1965 also helped strengthen the voting rights that Native people had won in every state. Now, in addition to barring many of the policies and practices that states had been using to limit voting among African Americans and other targeted groups, this act included provisions that required states and local jurisdictions with a historical pattern of suppressing voting rights based on race to submit changes in the election laws, whatever changes they made to their election laws, statewide, local, they had to submit those changes to the U.S. Justice Department for approval, or what was called preclearance. In the ensuing decades, these preclearance provisions proved to be a remarkably effective means of discouraging state and local officials from erecting new barriers to voting, stopping the most egregious policies from going forward, and providing communities and civil rights activists with advance notice of proposed changes that might suppress the vote. Yay, but stay tuned. In 1971, with the 26th Amendment, the voting age was lowered from 21 to 18 to allow young people to vote. Of course, thousands were dying in Vietnam. They were old enough to die in Vietnam, but they were too young to vote. So the voting age was changed from 21 to 18. In 1975, so that was 1971, in 1975, the Voting Rights Act expanded to protect language minority groups, requiring jurisdictions with significant numbers of voters who have limited or no proficiency in English to provide voting materials in other languages and to provide multilingual assistance at the polls. In 1982, Congress required new voting protections for people with disabilities, requiring states to make voting more accessible for the elderly and people with disabilities. In 1993, responding to historically low rates of voter registration, Congress passed the National Voter Registration Act, aka Motor Voter Law. You may have heard of it. This required states to allow citizens to register to vote when they applied for their driver's licenses. That's why you see that. That's why you get that. That's why it's so easy when you apply for your driver's license to be able to register to vote. The law also required states to offer mail-in registration and to allow people to register to vote at offices offering public assistance. And in 2002, Congress passed the Help America Vote Act. This was after the debacle of the 2000 election. So Congress passed the Help America Vote Act with the goal of streamlining election procedures across the nation. The law placed new mandates on states and localities to replace outdated voting equipment, create statewide voter registration lists, and provide provisional ballots to ensure that eligible voters aren't turned away if their names are not on the roll of registered voters. Now, remember I said that greater voter enfranchisement leads to greater resistance by regressives? Well, in 2013, the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act in its ruling on Shelby County versus Holder, paving the way for states and jurisdictions with a history of voter suppression to enact restrictive voter identification laws. 23 states created new obstacles to voting in the decade leading up to where we are today, and they continue. But resistance meets with resistance, and so it will continue. Voting rights organizations across the country have stepped up their work to protect and advance the right to vote and move all of us closer to the vision of a nation of, by, and for the people. This work includes litigation to challenge unconstitutional barriers to voting, on-the-ground advocacy to advance pro-voter policies at the local and state levels, and nonpartisan efforts to register, educate, and mobilize historically underrepresented populations so that they can participate more actively in elections and in civic life. And I'm going to share some of these organizations with you now. Now, I know some of you are still thinking, and I've heard it just the other day from someone I was really surprised to hear it from. The system is corrupt. Why should we even participate? Now, I see a string of successes in everything I just named. You may see only struggle and you may see only failure. And while the struggle is real, so is the success of the systems put in place. The system isn't letting us down. We are letting us down. When we rise to the North Star that's been set for us, when we rise to the highest principles that have been created, that have been envisioned, we're victorious. We win. We can see that. This democracy doesn't exist in a vacuum. Its principles and values are only as strong as they are exercised by the people. Demos in democracy literally means people. To not exercise these principles, to not exercise these hard-won rights, is to fly in the face of every single person who fought, suffered, and died for their right, for your right, for my right, for our right to exercise them. Stay home on election day, or metaphorically speaking, many of us will be staying home, so it's a metaphor, to prevent catching or spreading the coronavirus, but right, stay home on election day, or you know, protest the corruption of the system, refuse to register to vote, refuse to request an absentee ballot, tear it up, stay at home, don't vote, and you let the regressives win. You're complacent in corruption because that's exactly what they want. You want to know where you should spend your time as someone who cares about justice and fairness and compassion? Just look at where your opponents spend their time and get active. Democracy has never been easy. And it's been said, it's the worst form of government, except all those other forms that have been tried from time to time didn't work out so well. Yes, Thomas Jefferson's opening to the Declaration of Independence in 1776, that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they're endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Yes, that left huge swaths of the American public, 4 million of whom were owned by others in 1865. It left huge swaths of the American public out. Yes, Thomas Jefferson himself owned dozens of slaves, and he was as far away from living the very ideals and values he wrote about as you could be. Yes, it would be another 100 years after he wrote these words before those former slaves were recognized as equal before the law that said they were. And yes, it took another century still until those voting rights were strengthened. But in the systems created by our founding fathers is an aspiration that even though they didn't reach it, we keep aiming for. That's their gift to us. The fact that they set aspirations higher than even they achieved is commendable. And it means we can only go up from where they were and only up from where we currently are. That's a reason to hope, not a reason to despair. It's a reason for action, not for disengagement, not for apathy. In this way, I love what Ryan Holiday, you've heard me talk about Ryan Holiday, he's the author of several books, and he's the founder of the Daily Stoic. He recently observed, the arc of the history of justice and progress has been less about innovation and more about realization. What America did in the 18th century was bring the world closer to the vision inspired by the classical Greek and Roman lawmakers they were inspired by than ever before. What Lincoln and Grant did in the 19th century was bring America closer to Jefferson's vision than Jefferson had. And what Martin Luther King Jr. did in the 20th century was bring America closer still to the vision of Lincoln. Each one of these great heroes was fulfilling the work of the heroes that came before them. Each one was trying to help us realize the justice we believed in, but had not yet managed to achieve. This is the work we must continue. Today, Ryan goes on, here we are in the 21st century. We must get closer to those beautiful visions. We must move the ball forward, but also in a sense backward toward that timeless and true sense of what is right and fair. We don't need to talk about what a just society looks like. We have that on record. We need to help become one. You've heard me say a million times, we need to manifest the values we already hold. Are there barriers? Is there resistance? You betcha, and there always will be. So stop talking about the barriers created by others and start talking about the solutions that are in your hands. It's not a mystery. You're not starting from scratch, and someone else has probably already done the hard work. All you need to do is show up. So one, literally, first and foremost, make sure you are registered to vote and register if you're not. Now, on my website at joyfulvegan.com for today's episode and any article I have written recently that's on my website that's about voting, there is a registration tool you can use, number one, to check your status, and number two, to register to vote. Now, at this link, you can see if you register to vote. You can register to vote. There's going to be four forms for you. They might not all be applicable. So first, you can check to see if you're registered to vote. Number two, you can just register to vote using that link. Number three, you can get an absentee ballot. And number four, you can also sign up for election reminders. Now, here's something really funny, funny, not funny, and ironic. I decided to just go click on that link and say, of course I'm registered. Let me just confirm that. I clicked on it. I put in my information and I wasn't registered to vote, which is crazy because I've been voting and my absentee ballot was sent to me like literally in the last election. So I don't know what happened. I really don't know if I was purged. I don't know. But clearly something went wrong because I wasn't registered. And you can check with different addresses. You can check with different name spellings. But I even went over to the California Secretary of State website and I wasn't registered. So don't assume you're registered. I mean, just don't. Check to see if you're registered and check to see if your friends and family are, encourage them to do so as well. Everybody you talk to, you should be asking them, you know, you should go over and just confirm it. Just make sure. It's so easy. It takes no time. So if you're not, and what I did was obviously I registered again. I got my confirmation. Now I'm just waiting for the actual confirmation in the mail, but I do have my email receipt. It's just really weird and really scary. I checked to see if David was registered and he was. So I can't for the life of me understand why I wasn't or how I stopped being registered. So don't take it for granted that you're in the system. Go check now and get ahead of the game. Go to joyfulvegan.com, click on any blog post about voting, search for voting, or go to the episode, the page for today's episode, and you will see the forms there for you to check. Now, as I write this, we are still in the middle of a deadly pandemic called COVID-19, if you haven't heard of it, which is already having an impact on our voting system. According to the Nonpartisan Center for Election Innovation and Research, the number of new voters registered across 11 states in April of 2020 decreased by 70% compared with April of 2016. Registration plummeted as the two most popular methods of signing up voters, third party at schools and other public venues, and motor vehicle registration, they virtually halted because of the coronavirus pandemic, which closed schools, closed public venues, and closed many DMVs. So David Becker, who's the executive director of the Center for Election Innovation and Research, said other efforts to register voters are going to be more important than ever. If we're completely opened up and no one's worried about the virus in September, we're probably going to be okay. But I don't know. Many people aren't banking on that. I think most public health experts are saying we're going to need to be hunkered down for a lot longer. So that's a concern, is the reduction in people registering to vote, right? And then you've got all the means of voter suppression, such as requiring an excuse for absentee voting, or an excuse for, you have to provide an excuse for voting early, needless early voter registration deadlines, gerrymandering, finding pretext to scrub voters from the rolls, closing polling places in selected neighborhoods so that voters must travel long distances or wait in long lines, impeding voting in college towns, opposing automatic or same-day registration, blocking former prisoners from voting. Florida recently passed a referendum that got two-thirds of the voters that approved it, saying that former felons who've served their time should be allowed to vote. Still, that's been a problem. Putting in place obstructive voter ID laws, as I mentioned, lack of awareness of the dates of elections or the deadlines to register to vote, limited voting hours. These barriers tend to impact low-income workers, single-parent families, and caregivers the most. And in those groups, people of color, women, college students, and the elderly are disproportionately represented. So those are problems. Yes, they are. Now, here are the organizations working on the solutions. If you want progress in human rights, animal rights, environmental protection, name it, we need to exercise our democratic right and make sure others can exercise theirs. So I'm going to give you three organizations. There's more on the website. There's plenty more out there. I'd love to hear from you what you're involved in. These are pretty bipartisan. I'm not suggesting any groups that say vote for one party or another. These are about getting people to be registered, you know, to make sure that they aren't blocked, they're not suppressed, etc. So the first one is called Spread the Vote. It's an organization dedicated to helping people get IDs ahead of Election Day. Because these voter ID laws disproportionately affect communities of color and the elderly and new voters, Spread the Vote helps people to navigate their state's ID laws and assist them with everything from application fees to driving you to the DMV to get your ID. So you can go to a local chapter, you can join one, you can start one, you can donate, you can volunteer at spreadthevote.org. So that's one I would really recommend in terms of, like, let's say, like me, I live in California, so no voter ID. There are no voter ID laws in California. There are in many, many other states, but not in California. So, okay, that's not an issue for me here or anybody here, but there are other issues, and I can help people in other places. So, or you can even just donate. You can donate. So spreadthevote.org. Another one is related to voter IDs, is called Vote Riders, RIDERS.org, VoteRiders.org, and all of these will be on the website. In addition to people who lack acceptable ID to vote, confusion and intimidation serve to prevent millions more eligible voters from voting, even if they have a valid ID in their state. So what Vote Riders does is they offer free assistance for any eligible voter who encounters barriers to securing their ID to vote. If you or someone you know needs assistance or has questions, you can call their voter ID helpline. So go to voteriders.org, click on your state. I think it'd be really interesting for you to click on your state and see what the ID laws are where you live. Even poll workers are confused, and they sometimes ask voters for ID when none is required. So it'd be really good for you to know what your state's laws are. You can even print it and keep it in your wallet and bring it to you if you go to the polls, but you can bring it with you, and just so you have it, you know what the law is. In addition to providing information about voter ID requirements for every voter in every state, VoteRiders.org also partners with local organizations to find and help voters with these IDs. So go to VoteRiders.org. You can click on volunteering. You can get involved with phone banking or text banking. I've done text banking. I can tell you that it's very rewarding work. And I'm still doing with a local organization in addition to the work I'm doing with the organization I'm about to tell you about, but I do it with another local organization. Text banking is really rewarding, I can tell you. Now, I want to tell you about an organization. It's called VoteForward.org. I have volunteered with them. I love what they do. I love how easy they make it for people like me who want to help. And I did film a video, and it's on my website, about Vote Forward and how it works. It's super awesome. The concept is so simple. I love it so much. It's proven to be effective, but it's so simple. You just need a printer and some stamps, and you send a letter to registered voters encouraging them to vote. It's one of the easiest things you can do that meaningfully increases the odds that the recipient of your letter will vote. Now, obviously, there's a lot of uncertainty around the election process right now because of COVID, including how people will vote. But one thing is certain, it's critical they need to, if this episode wasn't clear enough, and just getting a reminder actually increases the chance that they will. So the letters, you adopt voters. You adopt either 5 at a time, 20 at a time. You can do as many as you want. You print those letters, and those letters, so the letters are they're pre-written for the most part, but there's some areas that are left blank. That's where you handwrite the person's name. That's where you handwrite, you know, kind of what voting means to you and why it's so important and why you love to vote, right? And then you sign your name, and then you handwrite the person's name and address on the envelope, and you put a stamp on it. That's how it works. So it's all the tools are given to you, except that you're providing the envelopes and stamps. So it's okay. It's what you. This is part of the volunteering. And it doesn't matter. You're not telling them how to vote. You're not mentioning political affiliation. You're just urging them to vote. Remember what I said earlier? The progressive idea of making sure everyone is supported and flourishing, that idea is shared by the majority of people. So just in encouraging people to vote, you're encouraging them to vote for progress. By virtue of them voting, the likelihood is that they will vote for progress. So the organization has a goal to get 10 million letters sent before the election. So you can adopt as many people at a time as you want, but they're asking you to hold on to the letters until we get closer to election day, because otherwise people will forget about your inspirational nudge. But like I said, you can adopt 5 or 20. If you did 5 a day, like, you'll just start compiling these. So you have a stockpile by the time November comes along, and you'll send them all out at once. So start ordering envelopes. Start ordering stamps now. Make sure you have ink in your printer. In the past, we've made parties with friends of the letter printing and writing together. Like, we would just kind of sit there and, you know, write out our little notes and write out the envelopes and while we're sitting. And you can do the same now. Make some modifications because of COVID. You can do it on Zoom. You can have a Zoom party online, and you can have all of you, you know, filling out letters together while you sip wine or tea or seltzer or whatever. Or you can have a socially distanced gathering with just a few friends to do the same. So that's voteforward.org. You can go right to their website, or if you're interested in checking out that little video I did, it's it gives you a really good idea of how to go about it. So there are three. There are so many ways to get involved. I cannot wait to hear what you are doing and what you think about these suggestions. I look forward to hearing from you, and I want to hear your stories of voting, of feeling empowered, of feeling emboldened, and let me know in the comment section at joyfulvegan.com. So I'm going to end with the words of President Lyndon Johnson from his March 15th, 1965 speech to a joint session of Congress. He had already signed the Civil Rights Act, but it lacked the teeth, it lacked the voting rights support. It didn't have enough about voting rights. And so he's urging Congress in this March 15th joint session of Congress to bring him a bill, a voting rights bill that will have teeth, that will be quickly passed. And so he's urging Congress to do this in his speech. If you've never listened to Johnson, and if you've never listened to this speech, just go to YouTube and type it in, March 15th, 1965, voting rights bill, President Johnson, whatever you want to put in. And watch some of it, listen to some of it. It's quite moving. And at his urging, that was in March, in August of 1965, he signed the Voting Rights Act. So here's just a short excerpt that I thought I would end with. I look forward to hearing from you for the animals, both human and non-human. This is Colleen Patrick-Gaudreau. Thanks for listening.
Our fathers believed that if this noble view of the rights of man was to flourish, it must be rooted in democracy, the most basic right of all was the right to choose your own leaders. The history of this country, in large measure, is the history of expansion of that right to all of our people. Many of the issues of civil rights are very complex and most difficult. But about this, there can and should be no argument. Every American citizen must have an equal right to vote. There is no reason which can excuse the denial of that right. There is no duty which weighs more heavily on us than the duty we have to ensure that right. Yet the harsh fact is that in many places in this country, men and women are kept from voting simply because they are Negroes. Every device of which human ingenuity is capable has been used to deny this right. The Negro citizen may go to register only to be told that the day is wrong, or the hour is late, or the official in charge is absent. And if he persists, and if he manages to present himself to the registrar, he may be disqualified because he did not spell out his middle name or because he abbreviated a word on the application. And if he manages to fill out an application, he is given a test. The registrar is the sole judge of whether he passes this test. He may be asked to recite the entire Constitution or explain the most complex provisions of state law. And even a college degree cannot be used to prove that he can read and write. For the fact is that the only way to pass these barriers is to show a white skin. Experience has clearly shown that the existing process of law cannot overcome systematic and ingenuous discrimination. No law that we now have on the books, and I have helped to put three of them there, can ensure the right to vote when local officials are determined to deny it. In such a case, our duty must be clear to all of us. The Constitution says that no person shall be kept from voting because of his race or his color. We have all sworn an oath before God to support and to defend that Constitution. We must now act in obedience to that oath. Wednesday, I will send to Congress a law designed to eliminate illegal barriers to the right to vote. We cannot, we must not, refuse to protect the right of every American to vote in every election that he may desire to participate in. And we ought not, and we cannot, and we must not wait another 8 months before we get a bill. We have already waited 100 years and more, and the time for waiting is gone. So I ask you to join me in working long hours, and nights, and weekends if necessary, to pass this bill. And I don't make that request lightly. For from the window where I sit with the problems of our country, I recognize that from outside this chamber is the outraged conscience of a nation, the grave concern of many nations, and the harsh judgment of history on our acts. But even if we pass this bill, the battle will not be over. What happened in Selma is part of a far larger movement which reaches into every section and state of America. It is the effort of American Negroes to secure for themselves the full blessings of American life. Their cause must be our cause too, because it's not just Negroes, but really it's all of us who must overcome the crippling legacy of bigotry and injustice. And we shall overcome. As a man whose roots go deeply into Southern soil, I know how agonizing racial feelings are. I know how difficult it is to reshape the attitudes and the structure of our society. But a century has passed, more than 100 years, since the Negro was free, and he is not fully freed tonight. It was more than 100 years ago that Abraham Lincoln, a great president of another party, signed the Emancipation Proclamation. But emancipation is a proclamation and not a fact. A century has passed, more than 100 years, since equality was promised. And yet the Negro is not equal. A century has passed since the day of promise, and the promise is unkept. The time of justice has now come. And I tell you that I believe sincerely that no force can hold it back. It is right in the eyes of man and God that it should come. And when it does, I think that day will brighten the lives of every American. For Negroes are not the only victims. How many white children have gone uneducated? How many white families have lived in stark poverty? How many white lives have been scarred by fear because we've wasted our energy and our substance to maintain the barriers of hatred and terror? And so I say to all of you here and to all in the nation tonight that those who appeal to you to hold on to the past do so at the cost of denying you your future. This great, rich, restless country can offer opportunity and education and hope to all black and white, all North and South, sharecropper and city dweller. These are the enemies. Poverty, ignorance, disease, they are enemies, not our fellow man, not our neighbor. And these enemies too, poverty, disease, and ignorance, we shall overcome. Now let none of us in any section look with prideful righteousness on the troubles in another section or the problems of our neighbors. There's really no part of America where the promise of equality has been fully kept. In Buffalo as well as in Birmingham, in Philadelphia as well as Selma, Americans are struggling for the fruits of freedom. This is one nation. What happens in Selma or in Cincinnati is a matter of legitimate concern to every American. But let each of us look within our own hearts and our own communities, and let each of us put our shoulder to the wheel to root out injustice wherever it exists.